Yes, I have lots of control and lots of control in the dynamics on the timbre. I use lots of MIDI to process these sounds, and I believe, I strongly believe in very dynamic music, in the power of dynamics and not just on the big block of sound. But this is for my music. Sometimes I like blocks of sounds as well. But like in my music, I like dynamic, I like narrative, I like controlling the sounds to the point where I can also, be very, very quiet and very, very loud. Yeah, I still love that. I still love, I don't know, some classical music records, even if I'm not a classical music fan or anything, but the power of just having like very little sound and then like a big sound after, it's that move. It's I think it's still very important in my music making.
I can't be on the record saying anything about this.
What's that sound?
Hey, want to hear the most annoying sound in the world?
Proposition sounds intriguing.
Proposition sounds very attractive.
Still give up the proposition.
I tell you, it's a thoroughly sound proposition.
Seems a sound proposition. What brought you here?
Sound is the protagonist.
So my name is Andrea Berti. I'm a musician. I'm a drummer and composer. I grew up in Italy, in Verona. I've been living in Berlin since 2011. And my main way of expressing myself at the moment is a solo performance where I play drums and electronics together, and it's a solo set that I've been developing since like 2004 or something like that. So like in about 2 years, it's going to be 20 years, which is quite astonishing actually thinking about it. Okay, so my actual solo live set consists in a minimal drum set and a bunch of electronics, and an electronics let's say an electronic device. Let's put it that way. I don't use triggers really. I use lots of MIDI programming. So basically the sounds that I play are drum sounds and Nord modular sounds. The Nord modular is a synthesizer made by Klaviyo, the Swedish brand that does the Nord piano keyboards. Mm-hmm. They made it in the 90s, and it's a digital modular synthesizer that you can program on a computer. Best if you have a Windows 98, but you know, you can have a Vine version of it. Vine version. So this is really what I'm playing, like drums and Nord modular sounds, and I use a Roland pad mostly as a MIDI keyboard. I'm sending MIDI notes to one of the two synthesizers that I use. And I have a delay unit. Yeah, that's very important. That's also very important. I use that delay unit as an important source of sound processing, especially on snare drum, on a snare drum and on a hi-hat. I started using one trigger on my kick drum recently, but in general, I like to separate the two worlds and not having, you know, too much processing. You know, it's I try to keep the dialogue between the drums and the electronics quite simple. The programming of the synthesizer is very elaborate, so that's the most time-consuming part of my solo set, because I program sequences and notes and chords and whatsoever, and this is taking a long time actually to perfection one patch that then I develop, you know, that then I use on a record or on a live set. You know, I now of course, like, I don't even think when I program, because I know the synth so much, so well, that now it's, of course, it's taking much less time than in the past. I've bought my first Node Modular in 2000, actually, 23 years ago. So yeah, that's what it is actually. And I developed my sets, like, I had very different sets in the past. There was at some point I had a feedback system where I used two speakers hanged onto cymbal stands facing the drum head, like the snare drum and floor tom drum heads, and on the bottom of both the snare and the floor there was a microphone attached, like a contact microphone. So I would generate two feedback system, and these two feedbacks were filtered through the synthesizer. So I could manipulate the feedback with the synthesizer, and so having rhythmical patterns out of the feedback system, I could stretch the skins in order to obtain different tones. Mm-hmm. And with that system, I created a record called Vege that had been released by Room 40 in 2012. So yeah, in general, like when developing this solo performance or this solo set, my aim was to create drum sounds that sounded electronic, and electronic sounds that sounded acoustic somehow, like, or sounded like some sort of a choir or an instrument or an acoustic instrument. So like my aim was to do that. I mean, not, or my, or my let's say like my efforts were towards that aim. Doesn't necessarily mean that I reached that aim, because still, like, the, you know, synth sound like synth sound, but in a way that was the context I was trying to achieve in order to create, like, my sound vocabulary. So in 2016, between 2016 and 2019, I released a bunch of records that I can put in a pool, you know, like, or like I can put chronologically as developments of my solo performance, live performance. And those are like a Cera Persa on Latency. One it's called Alveare. It's on this small record label, not small record label, called Iki. Then it comes Or, and then Ore or Strata. And these were like 2017-2019. These four records are, you know, like I think I consider them kind of all together a development of, yeah, as I said, of what I'm playing solo today. Until 2015-2016, I used to play like very, very quiet solo performances. Like I would never reach like, I don't know, 90 dBs. I was always playing very quiet, very mellow music, because that's what I wanted to do when I first started playing solo. I wanted to play like super quiet music, extremely quiet music, with an instrument that it's usually meant for, you know, loud music, and combining it with electronics. I always liked quiet music. I always loved Léa Redig's music, for example. I always loved lots of Berlin Exzeitmusik music back, you know, like 20 years ago. My first idea was like, what if I play some sort of dub music, but like extremely minimal and very quiet, with long tones and resonant drums. So that's what I had in mind, you know, a little bit of rhythm and sound, a little bit of that music in mind. But then it was around 2015-16. I don't know. I had this need of going back to my punk roots somehow, and to express a louder version of my solo performance, trying to keep the language that I've developed so far. So yeah, I just started playing a bit louder shows. I remember there was one show in Milan which was very important to me, because I had to play very loud. I mean, it was a big crowd, like small, not a small PA system, but like a very DIY situation. Lots of drunk people, lots of people, you know, like, yeah, yelling and screaming. It's like, yeah, I'm just going for it now. I played loud, and then I thought, wow, that was really cool. I want to do it again. So that was a moment where I realized I wanted to play louder shows. At some point, I started a collaboration with a record label called Float. This record label was coming from Erased Tapes. So the owner of this record label was PR for Erased Tapes for many years. Developed all the PR strategy for Vince Fromm and Olafur Arnalds and all these people that were Erased Tapes artists from the very beginning. So that's why some people connect my music to some contemporary classic music, for example. My collaboration with Vince Fromm back in 2016. So I started collaborating with her, and it was the very first time that I started planning, you know, like a music video or like, you know, a more elaborate structure, let's say, meaning, you know, trying to find a booking agent. You know, like a less DIY situation, let's put it that way, because that's where I'm coming from, you know, like the punk DIY. And that's also, you know, what it's still saving myself, you know, and really helping me giving me like some sort of direction, you know, this tradition. But anyway, so I started playing loud shows. Intense live shows, also suited for different kind of stages. I filmed, I filmed a couple of live shows, and at some point, visual artist called Tariq Barri, who lives in Berlin, so he saw me playing a couple of occasions in Berlin. We shared the stage once or twice. And in February 2019, he wrote me saying, you know, do you have a booking agent? I have a proposal for you, because he was playing, he was already playing with Tom York and Magic Aldrich in Atoms for Peace. He was doing, you know, not playing, but he was doing visuals on stage with them. So he presented my name to Magic Aldrich and Tom York. And they said, yeah, we want Andrea on tour, and that's how it all started, through Tariq's suggesting my name to them. But they usually choose themselves who's gonna go on tour. And you know, it felt like, wow, okay, weird, but also incredible. I would have never thought about it actually. So it came as a surprise. They invited me for 10 shows in Europe, and then halfway through the European tour, they also invited me to the North American tour, which was 14 shows across the US and 3 in Canada. Yeah, it was a very interesting experience, really beautiful, and also also very, you know, strange, because you know, I played in front of lots of people, but lots of people waiting for the Radiohead singer. So but in general, like, maybe LA, where people, you know, come late and they don't give a damn about the opening act. You know, except like a bunch of, like, a couple of hundred of hardcore fans, you know, waiting for the show at 6 o'clock. But in general, like, the audience was always very good and always respectful, and always, you know, very nice and focused. It's very hard to, you know, I can't tell, it was a game changer. It really gave me lots of confidence, let's say, like, playing on these shows, because, you know, the technical side of the tour was impeccable. I mean, they're hiring the best of the best, so you're really, you know, in a safe place. In the technical side of it, you have, like, people helping out, and the sounds—it sounds always great. Sound checks were, like, you know, 20 minutes, you know, the most, you know, but it always sounded great, really. So, you know, like, there were, lots of positive sides on this tour. I loved it, and I'm still very grateful to them for inviting me. Yeah. So, like, 2019 had a very incredible year, because that was the year where I've been invited by Tom York, Nigel Godrich, and Tariq Barri to join the Tom York solo tour in Europe and North America, and it was somehow, like, you know, the highest point of this path that I took in 2016, where I started focusing on my solo performance, so it was kind of, you know, the peak of what I've reached on with this project, in a way, artistically as well, I have to say. I mean, not that I think that, I mean, it's still a work in progress, so I don't think there is an end. It's still I want to keep transforming this into something always different. But anyway, like, and then COVID came, and then you know, like, I felt like, you know, like I was putting aside lots of collaborations, of course. Like, as many of us, like, started, like, you know, needed people. Like, I'm a very social person, you know. You see, like, despite that I'm playing a lot of solo performances, like, I really like to, you know, hang out with people and play with people as well. So I thought, like, I want to play with people again. But, you know, at the same time, my daughter was born, like, you know, a month before the first lockdown. So, like, I felt really isolated, and then I started thinking, yeah, I want to compose for other musicians. So I started composing, you know, music for this brass ensemble where my friend Hilary Jeffrey was involved with, is still involved with, actually. It's called Zinc and Copper. And so I played with Hilary together with him on Mars when they they needed, like, a drummer and a trombone player. So we played together at some point for about 10 shows for about a year or so. And so we got to know each other. And yeah, that's when this project started. Like, that was a sparkle. Like, this connection with Hilary and with his brass ensemble. And their sound really beautiful. It's a trio with tuba, trombone, and French horn. They have very beautiful sound all together, like, as a trio. So I applied for fundings, state fundings for art projects, and I got some. So I could develop this project within 2021 and 22. And I presented Eternally Frozen for the first time last year at Callis, the institution that hosted the residency that allowed me to, you know, to rehearse with the trio and to present it. So Eternally Frozen is based on canons, yes. So it all starts from this museum in LA called the Museum of Jurassic Technology. I went there under the suggestion of my friend Carla Bozulic. Once I went there to visit California, and, you know, I went all over the place, and she said, you should go here, you should go there, and she said, you must go to the Museum of Jurassic Technology. Just take some time to get to go there, Culver City. It's I don't tell you anything about it, but just go. And so I went there, and yeah. It's a really fascinating place. It's such a weird museum, weird collection of stories, and I don't know, odd human craftsmanship. With that it's like, you know, it's really overwhelming. So, and I found this story about a bat called Diprung Mori. Like, it is an invention. It is like a fantasy, like, but it's really borderline, like, something that it could be something real, but it's not. So it plays a lot with that museum plays a lot with that feeling, you know, not being, you know, almost real, but it's, you know, it's clear it's not. But anyway, like, the story of this bat goes that, you know, in this in an area, I think probably in near the Amazons or in the Amazons, a bat could travel through matter by its echolocation skills, meaning, like, projecting, like, ultrasounds that would allow this bat to open the you know, to travel through objects, actually. And the story goes that this researcher, like, American researcher, goes there and then builds these huge lead walls. Like, just imagine, like, bringing, like, huge lead walls in the middle of the forest in the 50s. Like, how is that possible? But anyway, he traps this bat in a wall of lead, and then this bat is basically frozen forever in this wall of lead. And then I thought, like, wow, I mean, all this crazy story just to have, you know, like a representation of, you know, something. First of all, it's an invention. Second, it's like trying to freeze that in that ideal bat, like not ideal, like this mythological bat forever. It's kind of creating a myth. So it was a good inspiration for me, a good metaphor for creating something eternal, like, or like this attempt to creating something eternal, but at the same time knowing that it's not. Mm-hmm. I think that this really fascinated me. You know, I'm not pretending to say, you know, huge, you know, truths or anything. I'm just saying, I thought that was really fascinating, and it really triggered me, triggered my fantasy, triggered my creativity, and so I connected it with a canon, which is also some sort of a presentation of eternity. So yeah. Like that's why it's called Eternally Frozen. Regarding the circularity of the compositions, yes, I can also say that in a way this is coming, the idea of repetition, it's kind of a drummer thing. It's what is bothering neighbors and in both, you know, apartments and, you know, houses and rehearsal spaces. You know, like the drummer repeating over and over the same kind of pattern, but, you know, it's kind of embedded in a drummer when it comes to composing somehow. But in a way, this the idea of using the canon and the repetition comes from like different experiments that I've done by working with the brass ensemble. So I've written like very simple melodies. Like I've written like five or six melodies within an evening, actually. And the next day I just presented this to them and started like kind of crafting this canons all together. And then when they started playing like the canon like perfectly, then that was the time where I also started developing kind of a narrative and using the canon as a technique to express, you know, to build something that it's not just, you know, that has a musical development. I mean, I'm not saying that Steve Reich, for example, is not a musical developer. I mean, like, he's one of the biggest. But it's not as, you know, not as strict to the rule of the canon. But, like, I when I play music, I want to have, you know, I want the music to express something rather than just showing a technique, for example. Or just, you know, being diving into that technique and finding the beauty in that technique, yeah, sure, but then there is something else. I think I just get bored when it's just showing one technique by repeating it, for example. I'm a fan of lots of artists who are also just working on one technique, one thing, you know, like, well, one mic music for just one microtonal change between two sounds, fine, I love it, but it's not my thing. We'll be right back. Okay, so let's start from my connection with film scores, because I'm in a way I've been always a huge fan, of course, like, you know, of Morricone, Baccalo, and all this Italian soundtrack tradition. Mostly because it was home, you see, like all these films, like where we were watching when we were kids. So we in the 80s we were still watching a lot of those mm-hmm. films, and so I mean, Morricone he's an international hero, but at the same time for me, for a lot of people, it was kind of home. And so every time, for example, every time I try to find some inspiration, I just check what I haven't listened, mm-hmm. you know. And it's like, wow, this is great. It sounds like Morricone. He was like, you know, like a factory at some point, like doing mostly the same thing over and over. So like there's some good ones, some like, oh, it's okay. But some like really astonishing ones. Regarding Egisto Macchi, I think he's got a very particular sound, and his work is, I don't know, very particular, very interesting, very minimal, very dry. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's really fascinating, and there is some stuff that I can really relate to, some records that I can relate to, but I mean, I don't know his personal story so much. I do know, like, you know, his records, but I just thought that besides other references like Moondog, or you know, like some things that it's more evident, I think I wanted to quote Egisto Macchi because that's a source of inspiration. Yeah, that's a big source of inspiration for my music. And he was a percussionist, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And Egisto Macchi, the attention for the timbre is, yeah, it's very deep. And yeah, sometimes you have like super simple, you know, droney pieces with just a beat, this very simple beat, but the sound is so good. You're right. I can really relate to that, actually. Yeah, totally. Yeah, I like resonances on the drums, for example. I like to let drums ring in. Sorry, sound technicians. Yeah, I'm really sorry for them sometimes, but often I've been asked, like, is this a feedback? Sorry to stop. I don't know if it's a feedback or yeah, I can really relate to that music. Yeah, and to that way of putting sounds together, you know, starting from, yeah, most of the time I start from a sound that I love. Yeah, if, you know, like, for example, from the floor tom ringing, like, so I can, you know, synthesizer sound or pattern that I really like, you know, very, very simple things that inspires me to dive into them and to compose something with them. So yeah, that's a good connection between with Egisto Macchi's music, yeah. I think drummer have a very interesting perspective when they start composing music. So in fact, most of the time I don't want consider myself a drummer, in the sense that I present myself as a standard drummer, but I've been always trying to find ways to to make music with drums and not just playing, you know, backbeat or something. And that's why, I mean, you mentioned Vladislav Delay, which, you know, who's also a drummer, but not a lot of people know about this. So that's a good example actually, because my references, like, or the art, you know, artists that I think they're connected to my work, are those drummers who are also thinking outside of their drum set, using the drum set, you know, like, and also, you know, bringing what's in the drum, like what has been learned, like, by playing drums and by having that role, but at the same time expanding that role into something else. I really like more creative drummers that can, you know, can have still have a solid technique, but also they can just explore lots of other territories. I grew up in Verona, in the northern, okay, northern Italy. Yeah,
there's the beautiful amphitheater.
Yeah, the arena. Yeah, it's beautiful. It is. Yeah. I've seen Bjork, Radiohead back in the days playing. It's really nice. It's you know, very conservative. Unfortunately, I mean, I have lots of good friends. I grew up in an anarchist squad, which is kind of a contradiction, but in a way it counterbalanced what was, you know, like a very Catholic and right-wing city historically. It's a pity, because Verona has this, like, you know, very also rough tradition, you know, like, that could have been easily moved onto the other side, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. But like the Catholic thing is just... Yeah, so in general, I always listen to, you know, when I was a little kid, I listened to a lot of music, you know, from my parents, from my relatives, but mostly, you know, very commercial music. And then at some point, I don't remember why I got into skateboarding, but I got into skateboarding at, you know, 12, 13 years old, like, I don't know, we're talking about Italy in the late 80s, early 90s. So, like, you know, everything at that time still were coming 10 years after, you know, like, we, in a way, the skateboarding that I knew at the very beginning was, like, I don't know, the 80s, you know, full on the 80s. Meaning that when I started hanging out with other people, we were all into 80s hardcore punk, mm-hmm. like, especially American hardcore punk. Like, so that's where it all started. And at some point, like, you know, like, I was never a good, you know, I was never very good at skateboarding. But at some point, like, a group of friends were saying, like, yeah, let's play in a band. We need a drummer. So I said, damn, I want to play in that band. And it was called Wall Ride.
Nice.
Yeah. So I started learning drums because I wanted to play in that band. And I did play in that band for a couple of years. mostly music that I have a hard time listening back to nowadays.
Sure, yeah.
There is something that I still like. I mean, mostly the most, you know, the weirdest stuff. I don't know, maybe like 3-1-G stuff, like Heroin, Angel Air.
Right, yeah.
Klikataki Katawi, all these bands, I think from California mostly.
Yeah, great.
But it was a great school actually because I you know, I got into this, like, you know, DIY ethic, and also going to shows and organizing shows and going to, you know, as a band, we also traveled a little bit, mostly northern Italy. The scene was very small but very tight, and you had these festivals. When there was a festival, it was like, I mean, there, it's a thing, you see, like everyone would go there, and if it's like, oh, where's Francesco? Where is this guy? I mean, they didn't come. You knew everyone. So it was great, actually. I mean, everyone had a fanzine. Everyone, you know, there were a few record stores, one in Padova, where every now and then we would go to buy records. So it was a small but very active scene. And if I think about it, but nowadays it's like it was all together in a span of within like 4 years, I moved on. You know, I moved on to other things. But you know, when you're so young, it seems that it's a lifetime. So yeah, but it was very like the DIY scenes, like I was mostly into those punk bands. I had a thing at some point for New York hardcore. But it was a mixture of things, to be honest. Like the perspective we had from Italy was much different, I think, in my opinion. We were on these festivals, there were like, you know, emo core bands or like metal bands, and you know, there was a lot of variety because I don't know. There was a lot of variety, actually. We weren't stuck into one genre of music, but you know, still listening to Slayer, for example. It was fun and I learned a lot, actually, you know, by just you know, by doing fanzines and by doing demo tapes and distributing them. It was a great school. And in fact, lots of people from that scene are still, you know, involved somehow in art and music. You know, I keep meeting people like that come from that era, actually, that are still involved. Some, I don't know, booking agents or, you know, you name it, all from that period of time. And then at some point I discovered, I like to quote Gaster de Sol as a turning point, mostly because, you know, there were lots of bands from Chicago or like all over the world, like, I don't know, was also into Stereo Lab, but it was a lot of, you know, into a lot of music by the late 90s, early 2000s, lots of electronic music. But Gaster de Sol, somehow I like to quote them because because they created a bridge between like forms of rock music, post-rock music, into avant-garde music. And that's when I got into avant-garde composers and electroacoustic music, musique concrète, and lots of other stuff, you know, like Faust, I don't know, like, you know, krautrock. I didn't even know what krautrock was. And I think people kind of forgot how important they were, like Jim O'Rourke and David Grubbs, in that period of time where they presented through, you know, to a lot of people, this forgotten music. I mean, before the huge wave of how's that called?
Like the MP3 era.
Yeah, the MP3, yeah, yes, yeah.
Yeah, when everything was just a click away.
Yeah, or revival, let's put it that way, revival.
Yeah.
Revival. Yeah, okay, from punk bands to Rosalina Mar, I mean, it wasn't a big jump, actually. One of the guitarists was one of the people involved in that anarchist squad that I've mentioned before. Another guitarist was, like, you know, a friend of mine, and, you know, but in a way, like, we were having fun playing rock and roll, really.
Yeah.
And, but when we started playing with bass, and, you know, we had a bass player at some point, I don't know, it just happened, actually. And it just happened in this old-fashioned way where, you know, which we've just met in a rehearsal space and had fun and thought, okay, this is great. Let's just go forward. But together with our punk references, we started bringing in lots of more, you know, rock and roll bands, rock and roll influences, and in fact, we were kind of a, you know, two guitars and drums. It's not an easy selling band, but our forte was the live shows. And I'm really proud to say that I've never called anyone to play, you know, for a gig. We never had, we had a booking agent towards the end of our history, like maybe a year or something, but it was always people calling us for show, you know, because they saw us playing in another place, and, you know, today they call it organic.
So it was a conscious decision to not have a vocalist?
Yes, it was. Also, not to have a vocalist, not to have a bass player. At some point, it was just working, and we loved it. And by the end, we had pieces with bass. Drums, mm-hmm. bass, and guitar. That drums in Rosalina Mar, it's really has a leading role many times. But during the live sets, we had two frontmen, actually. The two guitarists were very engaging with the audience. And that made a huge difference, you know, like, because in a way I was the most determined musician in the band, which wanted to, you know, to create some more structure and have a, you know, and develop something into something more interesting, bigger, let's say, but also, you know, push the bands into you know, being more ambitious. But the two other musicians were really good on stage. Because of one of the guitarists, Bruno, is 10 or 11 years older than me, and he has a huge record collection. So I don't know. I discovered so much music through him. But anyway, I've listened to through him. I discovered so much music, so much rock and roll music. He's a mod, like, he's lots of Northern Soul, a lot of, you know, you name it. And at the same time, I was also, you know, into experimental music. So I had these two sides at that time, like playing in a rock and roll band with weird influences. Lots of King. I would say we were in the middle of, you know, in between a garage rock and roll band and a skinwraith band, I would say, in our minds.
Okay.
You know, like very noisy.
Yeah.
Probably just in our mind, but yeah. The thing is, when I started playing solo, experimental music, solo performances. I didn't play drums at all. I just played objects and electroacoustic devices and synthesizers and stuff like that. So no drums.
Mm.
And that gave me, you know, like, gave me the freedom to compose like even wilder things where on live situation, I don't know, I just remember that when I put everything together on a live situation, I didn't want to, you know, play something. When I started putting drums and the electronics together, I didn't feel like I wanted to play as loud as in bands like Rosalina Mars, for example.
I saw you perform with Valerio Tricoli at Unsound.
Uh-huh.
And yes. You guys, have you released anything of that duo?
No, I've never released anything with Valerio. He's snobbing me. I don't know, for whatever reasons, but like, it's like, no, I mean, like, yeah, we have this interesting relationship where we function very well on stage. But we never, you know, I never talk to him. Mm. You know, when he's in Berlin, fine, we have a drink and then we talk and then we chat, and then, you know, if there's an opportunity to play a gig, great, we'll do it. We have one piece that has never been released, and I want to find a way to release that. It's a 10-minute piece. We have two actually, but one is unfinished. And you know, we've been working on that for years, and then, you know, forgotten. So there is one piece, yes. No, Jonathan from Maple Death really is a really supportive person, and he really helped me out in a period you know where now lots of record labels are in, you know, are struggling, and I was also struggling finding a record label for this new record. And he was, you know, extremely supportive. He said, like, you know, I told him I want to release this in the winter because, you know, I need to start, you know, to playing shows again after COVID, and like promotion of this record will help me out to do that. And he said, yeah, okay, yeah, cool, yeah, let's do it.
Eternally frozen. There's a kind of dynamism to it. It feels like you're there's a push and pull between you and your system in a way, right?
Yes, I have lots of control, and lots of control in the dynamics on the timbre. You know, I use lots of MIDI to process these sounds, and you know, I strongly believe in very dynamic music. You know, in the power of dynamics, and not just on the big block of sound. But you know, this is for my music. You know, sometimes I like blocks of sounds as well. But like in my music, I like dynamic. I like narrative. I like controlling the sounds to the point where I can also, you know, be very very quiet, very very loud. Yeah, I still love that. I still love, I don't know, you know, some classical music records, even if I'm not a classical music fan or anything, but the power of just having like very little sound and then like a big sound after, you know, it's that move. It's I think it's still very important in my music making.